AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show on a Tuesday afternoon, but no Matt McNeil. You're getting Brett Johnson. That's me filling in for Matt as he's still taking a few more days to recover from his hip surgery. Hoping to have him back hosting the show maybe by the end of the week, but if you've ever been anyone who's had that type of surgery, whether it's a hip replacement, knee replacement, those recoveries can kind of be up in the air sometimes. So hoping to get Matt back in here, maybe on Thursday or Friday. I know for sure we're having Todd Mickelson guest host on Wednesday, but Thursday or Friday, TBA, as we could be having the triumphant return of Mr. Matt McNeil. But for now, you are stuck with me. Also joined by David Lyon on the other side of the production glass. He'll be serving as sir today. Hey, David, how's it going today? What's new with you?
It's going well. Not much, just kind of getting used to the change in the weather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big change in the weather from, I believe, a week ago Monday, where we had temperatures up in the 70s. I was out biking. In fact, I was even out biking around 6 or 7 o'clock last week and not having to wear a jacket whatsoever. But man, that has certainly changed. Last night, I had to turn my fireplace on for the first time, my heated fireplace. So that felt really nice, but kind of depressing that I had to do that in October. I normally like waiting until at least November to try to turn that thing on, but man, I was cold last night. Are you one of those types of people, David, who's like, I'm never turning the furnace on until October or November? Or are you one of those people like, I'm cold, I'm turning the thing on?
No, I will put it off as long as I can. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd rather throw on another layer or two, and I kind of like it a little bit on the cool side anyways.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I don't have that same philosophy, though, when it comes to transitioning from the cold weather to the hot weather. Like, I'm never hesitant to turn on the air conditioner. I kind of celebrate if I have to turn that thing on, like, in April. So I'm not one of those people, on the other hand, who's thinking, well, I'm not turning on my air conditioner until it's May or June. No, if I'm feeling warm, then I'm turning that thing on. Guess it comes from living in a cooler climate like Minnesota.
I think I have kind of the same philosophy going both ways. You know, it's like when the summer comes, I'm sort of like, bring on the heat,
mm-hmm.
You know, so I won't turn it on until it gets like, okay, I'm sweating way too much.
I got you. Yeah. Oh, so you're actually a little bit of the opposite of me. Yeah, I turn right away and yeah, you maybe wait a little bit longer. All right, well, let's get to the political news for today. We got a lot to cover, and here's kind of the plan for the show. So we'll have open phone lines for the entire first hour, as a good chunk of the hour is going to be taking a look at the political history of the United States. I'm kind of a history nerd, especially when it comes to the political parties, and I want to talk about how our political parties in our country have really changed over the years, and specifically talk about how largely during the first half of the 20th century, the Republican Party was a center-left party. Right now, I think you can make the argument that the Republicans are obviously a very right-wing party, but that was not always the case, especially during the Great Depression and even into the 1950s. We had many prominent national progressive Republicans, and even here in the state of Minnesota, we had a number of progressive Republicans that held the governor's mansion, that were senators, congresspeople, and really, progressive Republicans in Minnesota lasted a whole lot longer than they did at the national level. So coming up a little bit later on, I want to talk about the evolution of our political parties, because it's easy to sit there and think, well, the Democrats have always been the liberal party and the Republicans have always been the conservative party. Has not always been the case. The Republicans especially have really shifted their ideology over the years a number of times. Democrats have as well, but not quite to the same degree as the Republicans. So we're going to take it all the way from the beginning of 1789, when we had our first two political parties, the Whigs and the Democratic Republicans, which is still a funny name to think about, that back in the early 19th century and late 18th century, we had a party called the Democratic Republicans. Sounds kind of like an oxymoron right now. So we'll be getting into that later in the show. Also want to share some news we have about the Minneapolis Police Department and how they have largely not been doing their job when it comes to solving gun crimes. I'll talk a little bit about that in hour one, but we'll get much more extensively into that in hour two, when we'll be visiting with Patrick Coulican of the Minnesota Reformer. Also, hour two, we'll be joined by Alan Kolinge of Student Loan Justice to talk about What President Biden could do to try to relieve student debt for so many Americans, because once we hit 2022, a lot of people could be in some trouble when it comes to having to repay their student loans as that holiday on having to pay student loans begins to rescind for many, many people. But for now, I want to start off with some national headlines. And David, I'll bring you on this one because the folks in the Maine legislature are really debating an important issue, whether they can make the lobster roll the official state sandwich. Yeah, that's what they're debating in the state of Maine. From the Maine Public Broadcasting System, Maine legislative leaders have defeated a bill that would have made the lobster roll the official state sandwich, a move that will preempt debate over whether the roll is really a sandwich at all. So I love that amid all the big issues we have going on right now in Maine, they're trying to figure out whether a lobster roll can be the state sandwich. Where do you stand on this? Do you think a lobster roll is an actual sandwich?
Well, you know, Groucho Marx had a famous quote. He said, "Whatever it is, I'm against it."
So there you go. Yeah,
I think that kind of says it all in many cases these days.
Yeah. Whatever it is, you're against it all. That sounds like the philosophy of the Republican Party to some degree as well.
Very much.
Whatever
so.
You're for, I'm against. But,
yeah, but I don't know. You know, I've never had a lobster roll, I have to admit. So in this case, I might have to disagree with
It reminds me of whether when people debate whether a hot dog is actually a sandwich. I come down on the no side with that, so maybe I'd be on the same idea with a lobster roll not being a sandwich.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm trying to eat, though, more cleanly lately, too. I have to admit that. So I'm trying to do less meat and fish and things like that.
So probably no lobster rolls in your future.
Probably not going to rush out and have one, no.
Yeah, whether they are considered a sandwich or not.
That's right. Trying to do more of the vegetables and salads and you know, things like that. So I'm going to leave that one to the Mainers to work.
Yeah, we'll let them figure it out. It's still a state that somehow reelected Susan Collins back in 2020, which I don't believe.
I guess we do have to take that into account.
Yeah. I mean, all the prognosticators said she was going to lose. And if she had lost, we wouldn't be having to deal with Kyrsten Sinema anymore. We would have had a Democrat in the Senate for Maine, but not the case. And maybe that's why they're debating lobster rolls, is that, well, we already reelected Susan Collins. We may as well debate some other kind of frivolous issues, to say the least.
Yes.
All right, let's get to some other news for today. So Democrats are close to reaching an agreement, I should say, on the infrastructure bill. Now, what I'm curious about with the infrastructure bill is, and I had to be blunt about this, does anybody really care about the infrastructure bill? Because I feel like people who aren't necessarily big followers of politics really aren't keeping up with all the latest comings and goings with the infrastructure bill, whether it's going to be a $3 trillion package, a $2.5 trillion package, or what looks to be the final proposal of about $1.7 or $1.8 trillion. They are closing in on an agreement, apparently, on this infrastructure bill, as it looks like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema could be on board. More so Manchin. Sinema's always kind of been an MIA person. But I'm curious, if you're listening out there, how closely have you been following the infrastructure bill? I know there is a lot of good stuff in there when it comes to helping people out, but I think they're, when you talk to the average voter, I don't think that's necessarily at the top of the list of terms of things that they really think and care a lot about. To me, I think most people care about COVID right now and making sure people are staying safe from COVID and vaccinations. I think people also care a little bit more about voting rights. So what your thoughts on that? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I think it's easy sometimes to get caught up in that political bubble where you can follow along closely with what's happening in Washington, whether Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are going to get on board with this infrastructure bill. But ultimately, doesn't matter to the average voter in 2022. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I think most Americans are going to be caring a lot more about issues with COVID and vaccinations and supply chain issues, which could definitely rear its ugly head as we hit the holiday season. And voting rights, I think that's certainly a big issue, and making sure we hold people who were involved in the 1-6 insurrection accountable. Now, speaking of the infrastructure bill, I'll talk about it for a few more seconds because one person is not happy with it. That would be Elon Musk, who has blasted the infrastructure bill and the potential wealth tax that could come with the bill. Yeah, listen to Elon Musk if you want. I guess he can go work on launching more stuff into space. Or no, that's Bezos I'm thinking of that launched stuff into space. Isn't Elon Musk working on trying to get into space as well? Yeah, you're nodding your head in there too, so... Yeah, but I guess maybe if he has to pay this extra tax, he won't be able to send any more rocket ships into space. Overall, that's a waste of time anyway. So go ahead and cry about that there, Elon Musk. And what else do we have in the news today? Let's scroll on up. The main website I usually use is Political Wire. By the way, if you want to follow along with what's happening in national politics, go to politicalwire.com. They give you usually about a 2 or 3 paragraph summary of each story, so you don't have to spend a lot of time reading if you're kind of short on time or just want a quick overview. So good resource. Give them a little free advertising right now. A couple other things to highlight from Political Wire. Madison Cawthorn, he is, of course, the Republican congressperson from North Carolina. He has called for the formation of a commission to investigate the true origin of the coronavirus and the role the demon doctor Anthony Fauci played in its creation. That, speaking about issues that probably aren't going to play well in 2022, I'm thinking criticizing Dr. Fauci probably won't be the best strategy for Republicans. So Cawthorn, I'm guessing, is probably out a little bit on his own with this one. But then again, Republicans kind of move around as one unit now that they've moved so far to the right that maybe they will be trying to launch some sort of investigation against Fauci, especially if they end up actually retaking the U.S. House of Representatives in 2022. And one final note, at least in national news, this goes back to the infrastructure bill one more time. This actually caught my eye. The Biden plan will include $500 billion for climate. Good news there, probably nowhere near enough, as the White House is privately telling lawmakers the climate portion of Biden's roughly $2 trillion social spending plan is mostly settled and will cost around $500 billion. A huge number and would likely be the single biggest economic component of the sweeping package. It also isn't far off from the roughly $600 billion that was originally proposed in the bill that was cost $3.5 trillion. So just to back up, remember the Dems originally proposed a $3.5 trillion package on infrastructure with $600 billion dedicated to climate change. Well, now the overall price tag has dipped to about $1.7 or $1.8 trillion, but fortunately, not a lot of cuts, at least on the climate funding part, so at least a little bit of good news there. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205, if you want to join the conversation. We're going to take a break and come on back and talk about the evolution of political parties in our country. It's something I find really interesting to talk about, especially an era when Republicans used to be progressive. So stick with us. You're listening to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil here on a Tuesday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. During this segment and probably into the next, I want to talk about the history of America's political parties and how the ideologies of the parties have really shifted over the decades and the centuries, because we have not always had a liberal and a conservative party. Political parties have evolved many times throughout the years. In fact, if you talk to most historians, they say we've had basically six political systems in our country, or six party systems. That's why you sometimes might hear the term that we're in the sixth party system currently. What that basically means is that we've had major shifts six times in our political parties throughout our history. And I think an argument could be made that with the election of Trump in 2016 and the rise of Bernie Sanders also back in 2016, that we might be shifting to a seventh political system. But I want to go through and talk about the history of our political parties because they change a lot over time. And I just find it really interesting to talk about. And I think it's important to point out that parties can change their philosophy. And we're probably seeing that right now with both the Democratic and the Republican parties, with the Democrats becoming much more of a progressive party in some respects, and Republicans obviously leering more towards being a far-right party since the election of Donald Trump back in 2016. But like I said in the last segment, we have actually had progressive Republican politicians in our past, especially in the first half of the 20th century. In fact, do you want to take a guess at which party the first progressive president actually came from? It would be the Republicans. Teddy Roosevelt. He was largely the first economically progressive president we ever had in American history, and he wasn't a Democrat, he was a Republican, as he proposed things like, well, expanding our national parks and national forest system. He was big on conservation. Then later in his term, he was big for breaking up monopolies and attacking big businesses and supporting labor unions, not something you would typically associate with Republicans. In fact, in Minnesota, we also had a history of progressive Republicans. In fact, which party do you think was in charge in Minnesota when we had reforms to our state's mental institutions? Which party was in charge when we had the Fair Housing Act passed, or the Metropolitan Council created, or the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency created, or the inauguration of the Human Rights Department? Or which party was in charge when Minnesota ratified the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age to 18? Those were actually Republicans that were in charge of the state of Minnesota. Progressive Republicans. Yeah, they used to be a thing. So I want to back up and talk about the evolution of political parties, and let's go all the way back to 1789 and the beginning of our country with the Constitution, at least. So back then, we had two major political parties. We had the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans. Now, the Federalists were largely for having a strong central government. They were for modernization, and in terms of foreign policy, they favored the British. On the other hand, we had the Democratic Republicans, who were for a weaker central government, and at least in terms of foreign policy, they favored France over Great Britain. They were also against having a national bank, something that the Federalists were for. And those were the two major political parties up until sometime in the 1820s, when the Federalists largely faded away from existence as the Democratic Republicans largely became the dominant party. Now, that started to change with a guy named Andrew Jackson, who was elected president back in 1828. This is also someone that Donald Trump absolutely idolizes. Now, Andrew Jackson was a Democratic Republican at the time. Now, in the 1820s, the Democratic Republicans fractured into different sections where you had Andrew Jackson representing one faction and President John Quincy Adams representing another. And the party largely along pro-Jackson and anti-Jackson lines after 1828, where the Jacksonian Democratic Republicans became the modern Democratic Party, and then people who opposed Andrew Jackson became what was called the Whig Party, our last major political party that now no longer exists. Now, what did the Democrats of the Jackson era largely represent? Well, they largely wanted to have an agrarian society based around farming. They also wanted Western expansion and majority rule. Meanwhile, you had the Whigs, who were in favor of modernization, industrialization, having a national bank, also having a weaker president, and they were anti-westward expansion. Now, what's interesting to point out between the Democratic Party and the Whigs back in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s was that both parties actually had people who were in favor of slavery. They had pro-slavery and anti-slavery factions within each of those parties. It wasn't one party that was pro-slavery and one party that was anti-slavery. Now, unfortunately for the Whigs, the issue of slavery finally did drive them apart. That's why the Whigs eventually ceased to be a political party, since they weren't able to find an official stance on slavery. Democrats, for the most part, during that era, were pro-slavery. Now, once the Whigs went away, a new political party emerged called the Republican Party. Now, oftentimes you hear Republicans talk about the legacy of being the party that freed the slaves and the party of Abraham Lincoln. And they are absolutely right as we fast forward to the 1860s now in America. Yeah, the Republicans were largely in favor of freeing the slaves, and they were against the expansion of slavery. But what's interesting about that is that Republicans largely gave up on the issue of civil rights by the time we reached 1877. That's when we had the infamous Compromise of 1877. What happened in the election of 1876 was that Rutherford B. Hayes was the Republican nominee for president, and we had essentially an electoral tie for who would be elected president. And what Hayes and the Republicans reached as a compromise with the Democrats at that point was that they said, all right, the Democrats said, all right, we'll let Hayes become president if you drop Reconstruction. And guess what? Republicans largely went along with that at that time. And that's largely when Republicans kind of gave up on following through with civil rights and protecting African Americans back in the 1870s. It's not too dissimilar from what we kind of have seen in the modern era, especially when we go back to last year and look at what happened with people reacting to the murder of George Floyd. We have a lot of white very interested in promoting civil rights and in favor of police reform. But largely, people kind of lost interest in that issue as we headed into 2021. And that's exactly what kind of happened in the 1870s with the Republican Party. They started off as being a pro-civil rights and an anti-slavery party. But by the time we reached the 1870s, a lot of Americans lost interest in the issue. And that's when that whole anti-slavery and pro-civil rights platform of the Republicans started fading. So yes, when people say the Republicans are the party that freed the slaves, they are correct. But then ask them about what happened in 1877 when the Republicans largely abandoned the civil rights issue with the end of Reconstruction. So as time continues on and as civil rights and slavery largely faded from the national picture, Republicans and Democrats were largely divided along lines of debates over tariffs, monetary policy, and who could serve in different presidential administrations, largely issues that really only people who were in political power cared about. Now, where things get interesting with how our political parties change happened in the 1890s and 1900s, because that's when we started to see the rise of progressivism and, of course, the progressive era. Teddy Roosevelt was president in 1900 after, well, he was first vice president, but then McKinley was assassinated. So Roosevelt rose to power as the new president of the United States. And Roosevelt was actually a very progressive Republican. In fact, like I said earlier, he was the first real economically liberal president we ever had. And guess what? He was a Republican. He was in favor of conservation. He was for breaking up monopolies. He was pro-union. Those are stances you typically don't hear from Republicans today. Meanwhile, the Democrats also had their own shift towards progressivism as well, with a guy by the name of William Jennings Bryan. Now, William Jennings Bryan never became president of the United States. In fact, three-time loser of presidential elections. Yeah, he's a guy who ran for president three times, was the Democratic nominee for president three times, and he lost all three times. William Jennings Bryan was the guy that really led the Democratic Party to becoming more of a liberal party. William Jennings Bryan, if you're not familiar with this guy, really encourage you to Google him. He's an interesting historical figure. I would almost describe him as being the love child of Bernie Sanders and Jerry Falwell. He was very economically progressive, but also when it came to social and cultural issues, he was very conservative, if we were to put that in today's terms. William Jennings Bryan was in favor of adopting things like the Federal Reserve, the Federal Trade Commission, was anti-monopolies. He was for government control of the currency and banking. He was for voting reform and the regulation of campaign contributions. But as I said, he was also kind of right wing when it came to social issues, as he was very infamous, I should say, for being involved in the Scopes monkey trial, as he was very anti-evolution. So to me, he's a really interesting politician, being that economically he was very liberal, but when it came to social issues, he was very conservative. But as we look at the 1900s, it was an interesting time because both the Republicans and the Democrats were experimenting with economic liberalism, where we had Teddy Roosevelt for the Republicans and William Jennings Bryan for the Democrats. Now, what largely happened is that after Teddy Roosevelt left office, the Republicans went back to being a conservative party all the way through the 1920s, while the Democrats, for the most part, remained a progressive party, although there were factions conservatives within the Democratic Party. That's an interesting thing to talk about when we look at politics prior to like the 1950s and the 1960s, is that there were both liberal and conservative factions of the Democratic and the Republican parties. And that started to change at least a little bit as we headed into the Great Depression era. And I want to keep talking about this coming up in our next segment and how the Republican Party, after becoming more of a rightward party in the 1920s, shifted to being more of a center-left party after the Great Depression. So we'll take a break and talk more about that coming up next here as you're listening to Brett Johnson filling in on the Matt McNeil Show here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. The progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon, as right now we're talking about the evolution of our political parties throughout history in the United States, because we have not always had a liberal Democratic Party and a conservative Republican Party. Now, before the break, we were talking about the progressive era and how at least economic liberalism made its way into both the Democratic and the Republican parties at the turn of the century in 1900, where we had our first economically liberal president actually being a Republican in Teddy Roosevelt. And of course, the Democrats also shifted leftward with folks like William Jennings Bryan and then later President Woodrow Wilson. Now, at least on the Republican side, they've shifted a few times throughout the 20th century. Now, Teddy Roosevelt, again, the progressive Republican, served as president of the United States through the 1908 election. Now, his chosen successor was Taft. Now, Roosevelt thought Taft would continue many of his policies, but Taft ended up being conservative instead, and the Republican Party then largely shifted back to being more of a conservative party through the end of the 1920s until, of course, we had the stock market crash of 1929 and the onset of the Great Depression. And once that happened and FDR and the Democrats took power, both the Democratic and the Republican parties moved leftward once again, with, of course, FDR building up his New Deal coalition of progressives. But Republicans also moved in that progressive direction as well. In fact, I think you could make the argument that at that point, the Democrats were a left-wing party, while the Republicans were more of a center-left party. It's interesting if you go back and look at like the presidential campaigns of 1936 and 1940, and you look at the type of candidates that the Republicans were running against FDR. Take a look at someone like Alf Landon. He was the Republican nominee against FDR in 1936. Alf Landon was not for repealing the New Deal. His argument was that he could run the New Deal more efficiently than FDR. Wendell Willkie ran in 1940, and in some respects, he was the Republican nominee. He tried running to the left of FDR, even though Willkie was a Republican. In fact, Willkie and FDR actually considered forming a progressive party, I think it was actually called a liberal party, but that never came to be, as Willkie died in 1944. So largely this kind of center-left faction of Republicans controlled the party all the way up until the 1960s. Now, conservatives weren't completely gone. There were still conservative factions within both the Democratic and Republican parties. But they weren't in control of either of the parties. The Democrats were largely a liberal party, while the Republicans, like I said, were more of a center-left party. But when did that start to change? I think you can look at like 1964 as being really where a change started to occur, and that's where you had someone named Barry Goldwater running for president for Republicans. And he successfully was able to unite both conservatives in the Republican and Democratic Party. He was able to unite them into a presidential campaign and bring in some of those conservative Democrats into the Republican Party. And beginning with Goldwater, and I think definitely with the election of Richard Nixon, and certainly by the time Reagan became president in 1980, is when you saw the Republican Party shift from being a center-left to more of a center-right party. Meanwhile, I think the Democrats also started to make their own shift in the 1960s from being more of a liberal left-wing party to being more of a center-left party. You can kind of see that evolution throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, especially the 80s when we saw third-way Democrats rise to power with folks like Bill Clinton and others. In fact, I would make the argument that by the time we reached 1992 and the election of Bill Clinton, the Democrats had moved from being a liberal party to more of a center-left party. And I think largely through about 1992 to about 2016, we did have a center-left party, the Democrats, and a center-right party, the Republicans. Now, the question is, did that change in 2016 with the election of Donald Trump and even the candidacy of Bernie Sanders? I think you can make an argument that both Trump and Bernie Sanders shifted the direction of both the Republican and the Democratic parties. Now, at least in Trump's case, it's pretty obvious that he's shifted the Republican Party to being much more of a right-wing party. But the Democrats, I think, have shifted as well. And one thing that I think Bernie Sanders really revolutionized with the Democratic Party was the way that they fundraise. You probably remember back into the 90s and the 2000s and even into the Obama years was that Democrats always relied on corporate fundraising. It's something they embraced back in the 90s when Clinton came to power and certainly expanded more once Obama ran for president, was the idea that the only way Democrats would compete would be by raising corporate money. Bernie Sanders kind of flipped that around, though, as he was able during his 2016 and, of course, his 2020 campaign, he was able to raise a boatload of money without using corporations, just through a bunch of individual donors. And lo and behold, lots of other Democratic politicians have taken that same kind of path as Bernie Sanders. Not saying they've moved to the same political positions as Bernie, but they've embraced that same sort of fundraising style and I think have made the party at least somewhat more progressive. And it does make sense when you think about it. It's not that the establishment Democratic Party has seen the light and decided to become more progressive. I think they realized it's a lot easier and a whole lot more efficient to raise money through small donors than trying to raise money from big corporate donors. And the reasons are pretty obvious. If you have to raise money from big corporate donors, usually there's strings attached, where you have to give those corporate donors and those lobbyists time to talk to you all the time. They want access. Usually you have to give their relatives, whether they're nieces and nephews, positions within government. There's all sorts of strings attached when you have to fundraise through corporations. But I think what Bernie Sanders really did for the Democratic Party was show that you can fundraise through individual donors. And I think that's why you've seen Democrats largely embrace that strategy and not become quite as afraid of, well, angering corporate donors. Not saying all Democrats have certainly reached that point, but most of them have. I mean, if you even look at someone like Chuck Schumer, he used to be known as the ultimate Wall Street guy, and he's kind of moved away from that position to a degree. So I just find that evolution of the political parties really interesting, is that we have shifted kind of back to having more of a right-wing Republican Party and a more progressive Democratic Party over the past few years, especially after the 2016 election cycle. So I just find this whole idea of the evolution of our political parties really interesting to look at. They're not static. They can change their policy positions whenever they want and whenever it's convenient for them, as we've seen many times throughout history, how the Republicans started the 20th century again as being a progressive party, switched back to being a Republican party, and then switched back to being a conservative party, then with the Great Depression, moved to being more of a center-left party, then in the 1960s, they moved back to being more of a right-wing party. Our political parties can shift in our country. Certainly true with the Republicans and with the Democrats as well. So I just find that really interesting to look at. And perhaps we are looking at a new shift right now with the candidacy of Bernie Sanders back in 2016 and obviously Trump being elected back in 2016 as well. So let's take a break and come on back with more news. We'll get away from history and talk more about the news of the day coming up next here on AM 950 again. It's Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Stick with us. The progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Matt should be returning to the hosting chair a little bit later on this week. We have at least one more sub-hosting day, as we'll have Todd Mickelson doing a little more guest hosting tomorrow. And then hopefully Matt will be back on Thursday, but a little bit TBA on that as he recovers from his hip surgery. For this last segment of Hour 1, I want to talk about some politics in the city of Minneapolis, and we'll start off with the mayoral race. We haven't really seen a lot of polling data that's been showing us who's ahead in that mayoral race. Now, a number of candidates are seeking to unseat current Mayor Jacob Frey. Now, if you were to ask me who would be leading in a poll for Minneapolis mayor, I would be guessing no one would be getting probably above 30% of the vote. At least is my kind of observation, Frey does not seem to be that popular of a mayor in Minneapolis. Well, that was at least until I saw this poll that was released today. On Monday, all of Minneapolis, a political committee spending money to try to, among other things, reelect Mayor Jacob Frey and defeat the pro-police referendum ballot question, They were trying to defeat the police reform ballot question. The special interest group is supporting the reelection of Mayor Frey and also is for defeating the police reform ballot question. They released an internal poll which found Jacob Frey leading his challengers by a pretty wide margin. Jacob Frey came in with 44% of first choice votes. The next highest candidate was Sheila Nazad, who came in with 25% of first-choice votes. Third place was Kate Newth at 10%. Now, I know it's easy to sit there and say, well, that's a poll from largely the Frey campaign, or at least a Frey-aligned special interest group. And that is true that it is being released from a pro-Frey group, but normally these polls are not as inaccurate as you might think. Typically, if the polls are unfavorable to the candidate, they just won't release it whatsoever. So if they do have a good poll, yeah, they're absolutely going to release it. So I found that kind of interesting because I thought Frey might be in some trouble when it comes to being reelected in Minneapolis, being that, of course, we had everything that happened last summer, including Frey kind of botching a meeting with a number of activists last year. If you remember that back on video, he was asked about police reform and he ended up getting booed away from a crowd of Minneapolis protesters. But according to this poll, he's in solid position to become or to at least be reelected to a second term, although should keep in mind that Minneapolis has a ranked choice voting system, and it is possible that whoever gets the most first place votes doesn't end up winning the overall, especially if someone ends up with a bunch of second place votes. So remains to be seen what could happen in the city of Minneapolis, but we at least do have our first look at polling data in the city. Also in Minneapolis political news, what would happen if that police reform ballot question passes and the Minneapolis Police Department goes away and instead we have a Department of Public Safety? Well, we might have some answers, and this is some reporting from Max Nesterak in the Minnesota Reformer. The city of Minneapolis sent an email to police staff on Monday assuring them that they will not be fired if question two ends up passing. That, of course, is the ballot initiative that would replace the police department with a new Department of Public Safety. Minneapolis residents, with the entire country looking on in the wake of the police murder of George Floyd, have been debating the future of the police department for almost 17 months, and Election Day is just a few days away. That will determine the future of law enforcement in Minneapolis. Now, here are some quotes from this email that was sent by the city to police officers. Quote, "We recognize that this is a stressful time for all of you and has been a stressful time for quite some time. You all have dealt with so much and through it all continue to show up to serve and protect our community. As your city colleagues, we want you to know that we value your contributions and commitments and are here to support you. We hope that this information will ease some of your concerns." The email also tells the police staff that there will be police in the new department and they won't have to reapply for their same jobs even if the amendment passes. And the chain of command will remain in place until the city council releases and creates a new public safety department. So it's interesting that even if this amendment does pass, we're probably not going to see many changes with law enforcement in Minneapolis, at least according to this email that was sent out by the city saying that, well, there are still going to be police officers. They will not need to reapply for their current jobs, and the chain of command will largely remain the same. If you go through and read the ballot, it's largely up to the city council to come up with what this Department of Public Safety will look like if the police amendment ends up passing. So an interesting note to point out that this is not an abolish the police question. Anything but that. We can even see from the city email right now that even if the amendment passes, there will still be law enforcement in the city. Now, other news I want to talk about with the Minneapolis Police Department. This is something I'll get into much more in hour two with Patrick Houlihan of the Minnesota Reformer. But the Reformer did a study that showed that Minneapolis police do not solve 80% of the shootings in their city. Now, if I'm sitting here as someone, let's pretend I'm a consultant or something like that, that's advising people on how to campaign for being in favor of this amendment that would reform the police department. In other words, let's say I'm a consultant for someone who wants to pass the amendment. Wouldn't that be your entire argument right there? Look, Minneapolis police don't solve 80% of the gun crimes in their city. Isn't that your complete campaign argument right there, that the police aren't doing their job, that they're more reacting to crime than solving crime? That's not a very good number, that they're only solving 20% of their shootings. And in fact, it's not something that's just unique to 2020 and 2021. In fact, we saw a dramatic drop in terms of the number of gun crimes that were solved between 2018 and 2019. So if I'm someone that's out there in the city of Minneapolis trying to convince people to vote for this amendment, that would be my argument, that look at the police department right now. They're not doing their job. They're not solving crime. They're only reacting to crime. That, of course, is in addition to the fact that last week we had a Minneapolis police officer caught on tape largely admitting that they're not doing their job right now, that they're taking a hands-off approach to crime control, including out in the open drug dealing. You can find that over in MinnesotaReformer.com in that video where a police officer was admitting that to a Native American activist. All right, that's some news on what's happening with Minneapolis politics. We'll take a break and come on back with hour two up next here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome into hour two of the Matt McNeil Show. Brett Johnson filling in here on your Tuesday afternoon. Matt hopefully making his return on Thursday. Up in the air a little bit, though. Never know when you're trying to recover from a hip surgery, but that's hopefully the plan. Matt making his return Thursday or Friday. So you got me today, then Todd Mickelson tomorrow. Yeah, David and I were talking during the break between hours just a little bit more about how Republicans used to be a center-left party. I wouldn't even call it a moderate party. It very much was a center-left kind of liberal party that we had with the Republicans, at least through about the 1960s and, well, even longer locally here in the state of Minnesota. If you want to read more about that, I encourage you to check out this book called When Republicans Were Progressive. It was written by Dave Durenberger, former U.S. Senator from Minnesota. Matt McNeil had him on a couple of years ago, I think, maybe back in 2019, and that's when this subject really started catching my attention. This whole idea that weren't always a conservative party. And Durenberger, I've at least gotten through part of the book. I haven't finished it yet, but he does run through the history of the Republican Party of Minnesota and talk about how we did have many progressive Republican governors. Just for at least a few examples, Harold Stassen, one example, he was the governor back in, I believe, in the 1930s. And he, like national Republicans, was in favor of the New Deal. But his arguments against Democrats weren't saying that we need to get rid of the New Deal and be against what you guys are for. His idea was that we can be more efficient implementing the New Deal than the Democrats. Stassen was not the only progressive Republican governor we had in Minnesota. We also had Luther Youngdahl, who oversaw the reform of the state's mental institutions. Elmer Anderson, who actively supported the passage of Minnesota's landmark Fair Housing Act. Harold Levander was the Minnesota governor from 1967 to 1971. He created the Met Council, something that Republicans absolutely hate today in the state of Minnesota. Funny enough, it was actually created by a Republican. He also was in charge of creating the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the inauguration of the Human Rights Department. Again, three things that you would not think Republicans today would be in favor of, but all of those departments and initiatives were implemented by the Republican Party of Minnesota back when it was more of a center-left party. Like I said, back then I wouldn't even consider them by today's standards to be a moderate party. Back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, the Republicans largely were a center-left party, while the Democrats were more of that progressive left-wing party. Things just started to change back in the 1960s. So if you want to read more about that and the history of progressive Minnesota Republicans, check out former Senator Dave Durenberger's book, When Republicans Were Progressive, as he talks about how, at least locally in Minnesota, progressive Republicans were a thing a lot longer than what they were at the national level. Like I was saying, at least nationally, progressive Republicans started to fade away in the 60s. But here in Minnesota, they largely existed probably into the 1990s. I think you can make an argument that even Arne Carlson was kind of part of that coalition of center-left-leaning Republicans. But now they have largely faded completely by the wayside as Arne Carlson and Dave Durenberger and other former progressive Republicans are aging out and unfortunately are either no longer with us or are out of politics completely. So interesting read, When Republicans Were Progressive. I know Matt McNeil did that interview with Dave Durenberger on that book. I got to get the exact date. If I find that, I'll try to post that on social media if you're interested in checking that out. And maybe even at some point, I'll have to see if I can get former Senator Dave Durenberger on the show as part of my Tuesday and Friday interview series. Got a few more minutes before we head to our interviews, at least for the rest of the show. Again, coming up the rest of the way, we'll be joined by Patrick Coulican of the Minnesota Reformer talking about this excellent piece they wrote that details how the Minneapolis Police Department is pretty crappy at solving crimes. In fact, I had a friend texted me who I think largely summed up kind of what is the philosophy of the police department right now in Minneapolis. It's about reacting to crime, not solving crime. I mean, think about that. 80% of gun crimes in Minneapolis go unsolved. There's not even an arrest made. And even among the 20% that do result in arrest, that doesn't mean there's going to be a conviction. You still have to work your way through the court system. So, I don't know, as I look at this Minneapolis police ballot question, I think that's your best argument if you're someone who does support the amendment, is that look at the police. They stink at their job right now. They're not doing anything. In fact, they even admitted on video they're not doing anything. Find that over at the MinnesotaReformer.com. When we had a Minneapolis police officer caught on video talking to a Native American activist and admitting, yes, they're not doing their work right now. They're going to be ignoring out in the open drug deals. They're not doing anything. In fact, I know Matt even had some callers on his show last week that had some personal experience with police officers saying that, you know, we're taking a more hands-off approach to policing. So I think that's your argument right there if you're someone who's in favor of the police amendment. The police stink at their job right now, and we need to completely change it. You can certainly make that argument on moral grounds, but I think that's your most powerful argument right there, is that the police are inefficient and not good at their job, and certainly the data backs that up. Let's go to more headlines before we are joined by Patrick Coulican of the Minnesota Reformer. And, oh man, I'm already depressed by this headline I'm seeing out of Political Wire. Here's the headline. I'll read through it. This is hot off the press, so I don't know what this is about. But the headline says, Texas lawmaker to investigate books on race and sexuality. What a complete waste of time. Texas State Representative Matt Krause, a Republican, has launched an investigation into Texas school districts over the types of books they have, particularly if they pertain to race or sexuality or make students feel uncomfortable. Krause's letter provides a 16-page list of about 850 book titles and asks the districts if they have those books, how many copies they have, and how much money they spent on them. Gee, I wonder if he was in favor of that one Texas school administrator that basically said that teachers needed to have opposing views on the Holocaust when it comes to teaching about it. Yeah, that happened a couple of weeks ago where a Texas administrator was telling teachers in her district that if they have books that talk about the Holocaust, well, they got to make sure they also have books that present opposing views. That's all thanks to a law that was passed in the state of Texas that was largely had to do with critical race theory, but had many other unintended consequences, including, yeah, presenting opposing views on controversial political issues. Well, guess what? According to that Texas law, that could include the Holocaust. So, yeah, if you're going to be teaching your high school students, middle school, or even elementary school students about World War II and the Holocaust, well, according to this Texas law, you might need to teach opposing views as well. Yeah, absolutely crazy. Speaking of that, if I know critical race theory is always a big thing with conservatives right now, I think a good way to counter that argument is not asking them to define what critical race theory is, because, well, many times Republicans and conservatives can't define what it is. I think you can frame that issue in a much different way and possibly have more success. I would frame it as being a school censorship issue. In other words, if you're getting these conservatives who are proposing saying we need to ban critical race theory and we need to present opposing views, that's school censorship. That's getting the big tentacles of government involved into the classroom and not letting teachers do their jobs. So I've always kind of found that to be a more powerful argument, saying that if you're in favor of bans on critical race theory and other school reform measures that right-wing Republicans are pushing, just say they're for school censorship. Yeah, I know it's kind of a loaded term, but that's the way you got to play when you have one party that is definitely playing dirty right now. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Man, I only got about 2 minutes left, so where do I want to go with my last couple stories here? Let's go to Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, because both of those states want to launch audits of the 2020 election, similar to what the state of Arizona did earlier this year. So in Arizona, to back up, they launched an audit of the 2020 presidential election in Maricopa County, which happens to be the largest county in Arizona that went Democratic in 2020. Now, what's funny with this forensic audit that they did, which included auditors that had no experience working with elections and were conspiracy theorists, among other things, is that they found Biden actually won by a wider margin than the original results. But that's not stopping Wisconsin and Pennsylvania Republicans from launching their own audits of the elections. Republicans in the Wisconsin State Senate announced that they are launching a review of the recently completed audit of the 2020 election, just days after one of their own members said the audit had shown voting had been safe and secure. Now, what's disturbing about what they're doing in Wisconsin and also in Pennsylvania is that as part of these forensic audits is that they're collecting personal information of voters, including names, dates of births, driver's license numbers, and the last four digits of Social Security numbers. So when you hear talk about doing these forensic audits of elections, your personal information is on the line, and it's being given by companies that are conducting their audits. And largely, these companies are partisan and, well, for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of clown shows, as we saw in Arizona, where they took a bunch of voter data and drove it up to a cabin in Montana to forensically look at it. No one's known what's happened to that data that they sent to Montana. And, well, now they want to do the same thing in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. So data privacy, I think, is a big argument you can make when it comes to these audits, is that you can say, look at these Republicans. They want to sell your data to the highest bidder. That's exactly what they're doing with these forensic audits, as they're collecting names, dates of birth, driver's license numbers, and the last four digits of your Social Security numbers if you voted, and they are giving that to private contractors conducting forensic audits. Yikes. All right, we're going to take a break and come on back with Patrick Coulican of the Minnesota Reformer. Stick with us here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson back with you here on a Tuesday afternoon as we're joined by Patrick Coulican, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, as we'll be talking about a number of the stories that they've been working at over at The Reformer with news in Minnesota, politics, among other things. Find more at MinnesotaReformer.com. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Always a pleasure, Brett.
Absolutely. So let's start off with this piece that Rylan Eichens and Dina Winter both wrote that has to do with, well, basically, if you shoot someone in Minneapolis, you're probably going to get away with it. And it has to do with this very shocking stat that roughly 80% of the 879 shootings in the city of Minneapolis between the years of 2018 and 2020 have not resulted in any arrests or charges whatsoever. So, Patrick, a very, very shocking stat there that roughly 80% of those shootings in Minneapolis the last few years have not been solved whatsoever.
Yeah, I think it's an important piece of data journalism that our reporters were able to compile. And what they found really is investigative failure on the part of the police department. We've had a spike in shootings since the George Floyd murder and the pandemic. There's certainly a lot of debate around why that's occurring and who's at fault. But one thing that's been true during that time is that we're not solving those crimes. And as the number of shootings has increased, the percentage of shootings that we do solve has declined. I will note that this is not necessarily only a Minneapolis problem. It's certainly nationwide. And there's a significant difference between their ability to solve fatal shootings, where they do have more success, and non-fatal shootings, where they have next to no success solving these. There's plenty of mitigating factors here, factors that make it hard to solve these shootings. Police really had trouble getting cooperation from witnesses and victims, although one could certainly argue that's the fault of the police because there's so little legitimacy in the eyes of the public right now. And also they just have really just too many cases and they don't really have the resources, especially on the non-fatal shootings. We just don't invest resources in solving these. Nevertheless, it's still a massive failure, and I think it really cries out for some kind of action.
And I think talking about that difference between fatal and non-fatal shootings is significant to bring up. As I'm looking through more of the numbers that both Rylan and Dina were able to compile, this one really jumped out at me, that a suspect arrested or charged is charged at only about 61% of Minneapolis's fatal shootings as of 2018. So 61% of those cases at least had an arrest or charges filed back in 18. But that rate dropped to nearly 23% by 2020. That is a significant drop.
I believe, oh, more than half, if I do the math in my head right now. That's another significant factor to bring up. And as you were talking about, really, there's not a lot of resources that are given to these non-fatal shootings.
Yeah, I think what you were pointing to actually was the homicide solve rate, which has declined. Yeah, which has declined a lot in the last couple of years, because they're dealing with more of them, and also because they have fewer investigators. But on the non-fatal side, it's even worse. And I would also, I think it's important to note that Ryland surveyed the 10 largest departments in Minnesota on this shooting data, and a lot of the departments, including I think most notably St. Paul, they don't seem to track this data at all. And I that was just shocking to me that St. Paul doesn't even know what percentage of these cases that they're solving. And I liken it to an education system that doesn't test its students and just has no idea whether or not it's successful in teaching math or reading. And the thing about these cases is what it leads to is a kind of escalating cycle of violence, because you don't solve the crime. Well, now there's somebody out there who's looking for retribution, and he or she is going to take matters into his or her own hands. And so you just get this cycle of violence. And as that happens, now you solve even fewer cases, and you have less legitimacy in the eyes of the public, which makes it even harder to solve cases. It's just a death spiral that happens when you're unable to investigate these cases successfully.
What has the Minneapolis Police Department said about these stats that have been released? Have we heard anything from them talking about why we're not solving many of these gun incidents and gun crimes that have occurred the past few years?
Well, the MPD doesn't talk to the reformer a whole lot, but we do have some public comments that leadership has made about kind of how they've been overwhelmed in cases and they don't have the necessary resources to really take these on. And certainly they, Chief Arredondo has said that, I think he told the city council recently that they're down from, they had 178 employees in investigations in 2019, and now they're at 93. So that's a significant loss. And so you can kind of understand how they're, I mean, I think on some of these shootings, I mean, we have at least a little bit of indication that they're not even investigating them at all.
So I know Dina and Ryland had a chance to write about this a little bit in their piece, but what could be done to kind of improve those clearance rates to make sure we're actually getting arrests and convictions in these gun shooting cases?
Well, it has to be a priority. It is a priority for them to close out homicide cases, and you can see that because they have a higher they have more success solving those cases and getting an arrest or charges, and it's not because they're easier. In fact, they're probably harder because a key witness, the victim, has not survived. And yet they solve them at a higher rate. And why is that? Well, it's just because they put more resources into it. So if they want to solve these non-fatal shootings, which I should point out, are exact in every way, they're just like a fatal shooting, except that the outcome is just different, almost on either because the shooter is a bad shot or because of advances in emergency medical care or just dumb luck. Those really are not that much different than an actual homicide, and yet we don't put any resources into it, and we just don't pay attention to it, even though, I mean, it's got to be certainly one of the most violent and serious crimes that can be committed against the community.
And as you talk about not putting resources into that, is that just the case that we're running into police officers or investigators who just have such a big caseload that they don't have time to solve this as compared to someone who maybe is a homicide investigator? Is that kind of where we're going with that, too, in terms of, you know, maybe the people investigating these just don't have the resources that they need to try to solve these cases?
Right. Well, when you go down from, I mean, the police department itself is down 300 officers. In retirements, resignations, and disability claims in the last year and a half or so. And like I said, in the investigations unit, they're down from 178 down now to 93. So you can just see how caseloads just stack up. And they're just looking at these huge files. You have victims and witnesses who fear retribution or would rather take retribution into their own hands. They're not cooperating. And so they are just left with huge piles of cases and very hard to solve them, especially as time elapses.
You can find more about that piece over at MinnesotaReformer.com. Again, Rylan Eichens and Dina Winter did a great job. The title of the piece is "If You Shoot Someone, You're Probably Going to Get Away with It." Find that over at MinnesotaReformer.com for their great reporting. Speaking with Patrick Houlihan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer at MinnesotaReformer.com. A couple more stories I want to talk with you here, Patrick. And one has to do with Republican State Senator Mark Corren. He is a Republican from North Branch who recently drew some criticism and controversy for basically urging his supporters to donate to a legal defense fund for those that were accused in the January 6th riots, as there were was a couple of members of the Westbury's family who are from Lindstrom, Minnesota, who participated in the January 6th riot and are now facing charges. And Corren is urging his supporters to donate them because they're a good family. And this flies the face in the fact that Corren actually was much less generous in a recent appraisal of Jaleel Stallings, who, of course, is the St. Paul man who was recently acquitted of 8 charges in connection with his shooting at a Minneapolis SWAT team. Minneapolis cops were driving around in an unmarked van, shooting rubber bullets at civilians out past curfew without warning, 5 days after George Floyd's police killing. And Stallings, who had no idea that these were actually police officers, he was thinking they were white supremacists, since that was a problem back in 2020, started firing at the van, and once he realized they were cops, he immediately surrendered. So, as I understand this, Corren is under a little bit of controversy right now, saying that we should donate money to these 1-6 insurrectionists from Minnesota, while on the other hand, basically criticizing Stallings and saying that we should not be giving money to bail to people like Stallings who are involved in these types of incidents.
Yeah, interesting that our sources on this, on the original post from Corren, were Republicans who were alerting us, like, you know, telling us this is just beyond the pale. We don't want to be associated with this. To be raising money for the legal defense of someone who's accused, in one case, one of the members of this family used a shield to assault a police officer, according to the charging documents. And then two other members of the family, I think, wound up in the Capitol that day. Corren calls that, he refers to it as the rally on January 6th. I guess there was a rally before they marched down to the Capitol and then broke into the Capitol and tried to overturn the Democratic election. But it's just amazing how, people's perceptions of other people change based on who they are. So he has utmost sympathy for these people, this family who were accused of crimes, but then turn around and he blasts Jaleel Stallings, who's actually been acquitted of crimes. So the hypocrisy is pretty obvious. And one of my reporters told me he actually took down the Facebook post in which he asked people to give money to the legal defense fund of the Westbury. So I'm glad he thought better of it, I guess. But anybody who, if it indeed is true that one of these guys used a shield to hit a police officer at the Capitol while you're trying to break into the Capitol to overturn a Democratic election, this is not a fine family. Which is the phrase that he used to describe these people. Not only should they're not a fine family. I mean, they should be banished from polite society. And I don't understand why a state senator would be trying to raise money for their legal defense, especially since he has so little regard and empathy for somebody who was acquitted and was actually, in the case of Stallings, of course, after he surrendered, he was suffered a fractured eye socket on the part of Minneapolis police.
Yeah, and it's important to point out, too, that Coran is mad about giving bail money, which, by the way, defendants don't get to pocket that bail money. They're just using that to get out of jail. Meanwhile, he wants to direct legal money to this family of 1-6 rioters where they can, in essence, pocket that money to pay their lawyers. So there's a big difference there, too. And I know you mentioned that he has now taken down that post, and I imagine there probably are some within the Republican Party that aren't exactly happy about that post. Have we heard anything from GOP leadership about Coran, or have they largely remained kind of silent about this issue?
No, I think that's a good idea. We owe a call to the Senate Majority Leader on this, ask him what he thinks. We have not seen, I have not seen widespread condemnation from his colleagues on the Republican side. Certainly the DFL senators launched some attacks on Coran over this.
Well, you can read more about that over at MinnesotaReformer.com. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, who is the editor-in-chief of that very publication, Minnesota Reformer, as we've been talking through some Minnesota political news. And unfortunately, we are just about out of time, so we'll have to wrap up our interview now. Patrick, as always, enjoy the Tuesday visits and look forward to chatting with you next week.
All right, great to talk to you.
And again, a big thanks to Patrick Houlihan of the Minnesota Reformer. We'll take a break and come on back with more here on the Matt McNeil Show with Brett Johnson filling in on a Tuesday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon, filling in for Matt McNeil. Well, here on this last segment, I want to switch gears and talk about student loans, because student loan payments are set to resume within the next few months for most Americans after having a pause because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But what actions could the Biden administration take to help ease that burden of student loans? Well, I'm going to play back an interview I conducted with Alan Kolinge of the organization Student Loan Justice, who will talk about what an absolute mess the student loan industry is and some of the actions the office of the president could take. So without further ado, let's go ahead and play back that interview. Let's welcome in Alan Kolinge. He is the founder of Student Loan Justice. Website is studentloanjustice.org. Also the author of The Student Loan Scam and creator of a petition on change.org pushing Congress and the Biden administration to cancel student loans, something that's definitely been in the news since Joe Biden took office, being that during the campaign he promised to cancel student loans. So joining us to talk more about that and also some pretty shocking levels, there's pretty shocking numbers in terms of student debt at the state level, is Alan Kolinge. Alan, how are you doing today?
Good to be with you, Brett.
So what powers does the Office of the Presidency have to cancel student loan debt? Is this something that the Biden administration could do on their own, or is this something that requires congressional approval?
Great question. The president has, and the Secretary of Education, have full, very broad leeway to cancel any and all federal student loans, federally owned student loans, I should say, with nothing more than an order from the secretary under advisement by the president. So the Higher Education Act and the language actually goes back to the late 50s, believe it or not. Congress, decades ago, gave the secretary very broad authority to waive, compromise, release their interest in federally owned student loans. So this could be done tomorrow. President Biden could cancel these loans without congressional approval. Most importantly, without congressional appropriation. In other words, no money would have to be, quote unquote, paid. No money would have to be drawn from Treasury And incidentally, this would add zero to the national debt. So in terms of fiscal stimulus, there's really no easier, cheaper, and I would say more appropriate way to stimulate the economy.
Speaking with Alan Kolinge of Student Loan Justice, that website is studentloanjustice.org, also has a petition on change.org. Now, recently you wrote a piece going through some pretty shocking numbers in terms of what student loan debt looks like from state to state. In fact, as we took a look at these numbers, there are several states that have basically more outstanding student loan debt than the entire state budget, which is just mind-blowing to think about. As you had a chance to read through some of these numbers, did they surprise you at all?
Frankly, I was stunned. I sort of had an idea that some of the states were getting close to exceeding their total state budgets. And this is the big state budget, by the way. This is federal and state spending combined. I knew a few states were getting close, but I had no idea how bad it had gotten. So I looked at very recent Department of Education data, and it turns out that some states owe tens of billions of dollars more than their total state budgets in student loan debt. It turns out that Georgia, for whatever reason, turns out to be the worst. So the state of Georgia, their total state budget is $48 billion. Outstanding student loan debt of the citizens of Georgia is around $81 billion. So, and quite frankly, I really don't think, Brett, that many or maybe even any of the governors of these states are aware of this fact. You know, they know about the state budgets, but they probably just don't look at federal student loan debt very carefully. And so this is very big news, and we are trying to spread the words not only in those states that I mentioned, and people could see the press release for themselves at studentloanjustice.org, but around the country. You know, this is obscene, unacceptable, and quite frankly, this lending system has gone over the cliff. It's become a national threat at this point.
And by the way, in these rankings, Minnesota, we rank relatively the middle of the pack, so we still certainly do have some work to do in this state. But as I had a chance to look at these numbers too, what I found kind of interesting is that there did seem to be a little bit of a red-blue divide in terms of which states have the most student loan debt in comparison to their state budgets. Now, it wasn't completely true. There certainly are some blue states that are not doing as well as red states and vice versa, but that divide was kind of interesting to see. Are there any policies you're specifically seeing in states that are leading to these types of numbers? Talk about that a little bit.
You know, I don't have a good explanation for why 13 of the 19 states that owe more than their total state budgets in student loan debt, why they lean to the right. I don't know. You look at the top of the list and you see states like Florida and Texas and South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, Indiana, Tennessee, Alabama, Maryland, South Dakota, et cetera. It's a really good question. You know, some of these states tend to have lower per capita state budgets. But, you know, when you look at a state like Georgia where, you know, they owe 169% of their total state budget, you really have to wonder what in the heck is going on here, and why did the governors of all those states not spot this many years ago and act? You know, this is a lot of money that's being taken out of these state economies, and the fact that it appears to be hurting the red states far, far worse than average, it should be very concerning for legislators and governors of those states.
Again, we're speaking with Alan Kolinge. He is with the organization Student Loan Justice. And looking at the numbers from Minnesota, I believe we had most recently, I think it was a $38 billion budget. And was it $32 billion in student debt, or do I have that in reverse?
Yeah, that's right. So the state of Minnesota, their total big budget is about $38.7 billion. Mm-hmm. The people of Minnesota, Minnesotans, owe $32 billion. So that's 83% the size of the entire state budget is owed by the state in student loan debt. And, you know, most of that money is owed directly to the federal government. I would say probably 87%, an even higher percentage is owed to some bank out of state, typically, like whether it's in Manhattan or where it may be, it probably isn't in Minnesota. So, you know, all of the states are seeing just billions and billions and billions of dollars sucked out of their economy every year in interest alone. And it's astonishing, Brett. The fact that the governors haven't gotten together and really had a powwow, regardless of politics or partisanship or anything, the fact that they haven't gotten their arms around this problem after years and decades, it kind of makes me wonder what these guys are doing.
So I know we talked a little bit about what could be done at the federal level, at least from the Biden administration and an executive order. But what about at the state legislative level, or as you said, at the gubernatorial level? What exactly could they do?
Well, not a lot. You know, we have federal supremacy, so they don't have any real power to have direct influence over the problem. You know, what the governors could do, which would be extraordinarily strong, is simply collectively, hopefully, call on the president to cancel these loans. You know, I guess in the worst case scenario, state legislatures could do some fairly radical things and, you know, bar student loan collection companies and other companies from operating in their states. You know, maybe offer some sort of safe harbor legislation, that sort of thing. But you know, Brett, I think if many, if not most of the governors of the country in a single voice stood up and said, Mr. President, cancel these loans, I think it would probably happen, you know, particularly if some conservative governors would stand up and stop fighting for Washington, D.C. and the student loan swamp, as I call it, and start fighting for their own citizens. I think that message would be strong enough to win the day.
And the problem is only going to get much, much worse as we head into the future, because as you wrote, the class of 2004 is already defaulting on their loans 40% of the time, but they were only borrowing one third of what's being borrowed today. And that is a scary number to think about in terms of what kind of debt numbers we could be looking at in 10, 20 or 30 years from now.
Yeah, Brett, you know, by all rational metrics and measures, this lending system is a catastrophic, and I mean catastrophic failure. You know, even before the pandemic, the guy who literally ran the federal lending system after he stepped down before the pandemic, Wayne Johnson is his name, he told me that 80% of all federal student loan borrowers were never going to be able to repay their loans, even before the pandemic. So, you know, I think we're probably looking at a default rate among all current borrowers of something like 75, 80, 85%. And, you know, by way of comparison, the default rate for subprime home mortgages, which was our most recent failed lending system, the default rate for those loans was only 18%. So we are well over probably four times higher than that. So I don't know what other evidence you need to see to say, yeah, this lending system it's done. It's toast.
Couple more final questions for you here, Alan. This is another one that I think is important to point out when people think about student loan debt. It's not just people in their 20s and 30s that have just these ridiculously huge numbers in terms of their debt. There's a lot of people who are in their 40s or 50s that still owe thousands and thousands of dollars in debt.
You know, Brett, believe it or not, and this is a piece of research that we discovered in December, it turns out the highest balance borrowers in this country are over 50 years old. And more than that, there are more people in the country over the age of 50 who have student loans than there are people under the age of 25, which is just astonishing. You know, the way people think about student loans is, okay, yeah, you get your loans in your 20s, you pay them off in your 30s, if you're in your 40s, you still have a student loan. That's probably pretty rare. And, you know, it's almost unheard of that people in their 50s would have any student loan debt. That's the common misconception. But it turns out that, in fact, the opposite of that is true. And again, you know, that's just one more piece of evidence that shows very clearly that this lending system is just done. It's vanishing into a mist of illegitimacy. I really think this pandemic is and should be the nail in the coffin of this thing. You know, as a country, we've got to rethink how to fund the colleges in this country. This lending system was maybe a good idea back in the 60s, but the way they turned the lending system into a predatory lending instrument, removing bankruptcy protections that the founders called for in the Constitution, removing statutes of limitations, putting in place a mafia-like collection regime. They've really weaponized these loans, and at this point, there is simply no saving it. The easiest, most efficient way to move forward is to be done with these loans, and not partial. This lending system can't be allowed to continue. All the loans must be canceled. And whatever happens in Washington, Brett, you know, nobody is paying on their student loans right now during the pandemic. Even before the pandemic, very few people were, less than half. And whenever they try to lift this repayment suspension, you know, the reality is that very few people will resume making payments. Student loans essentially have become one huge, very painful national joke at this point.
So if people want to get involved and encourage the Biden administration or Congress to act on this, I know you guys have a petition over at change.org and your own website as well at studentloanjustice.org. But tell people how they can get involved in terms of trying to put more pressure to get student loans canceled.
Absolutely. Number one, this is not a thing that Congress can do, really. This comes down to President Biden. We have to push President Biden to cancel these loans. He has already signaled some resistance to that. He's kind of dragging his feet. I would urge everybody there, particularly people that live in or know people who live in the 19 states that are mentioned in our report, get with the governors. You know, the governors cannot allow this to happen on their watch. So we need to put pressure on the president. We need to put pressure on the governors. One thing we do need Congress for is returning bankruptcy protections to all student loans. So there are quite a few student loans out there that the president cannot cancel by executive order. We absolutely must get constitutional bankruptcy protections returned to those. So if people want to call their congressperson, don't waste your time talking about loan cancellation. Push your members of Congress, particularly your senators, particularly your Republican senators, to return bankruptcy protections to all student loans. That really should have happened decades ago, and it would have saved us a lot of the pain and everything that we're seeing now here today.
That's Alan Colin. She is the founder of Student Loan Justice. That website is studentloanjustice.org, and they also have a petition over at change.org. Alan, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you, Brett.
All right, and that'll just about wrap things up for the show today. Again, this has been Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil. Todd Mickelson will be back in the hosting chair tomorrow filling in for Matt. And then Matt McNeil makes his return on Thursday, so look forward to that. Thanks for listening, and make sure you stay tuned for Native Roots Radio up next on AM 950.